My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. So, hope you're good. Hope you've been enjoying this new season. So far in the season, we've done a not-so-good album, a kind of middling album, I guess, and now we're going to do a really great album. Although, having said that, we'll get into this in the episode, so I'll try not to repeat myself too much, but I think this album is technically brilliant. I think it's got some of Bob's best performances in this era on it. I think it's got some his best songs, some really interesting lyrics. It's got a kind of fascinating tone, especially when you dig a little bit deeper, as I hope we do in this episode. But it's not an album I necessarily love. I don't know if you have this with TV shows and films and music and other types of media or other things you consume, but I can tell if something, or I can certainly understand if something's really well made, or I think's well made, something that's really well constructed, that's very artistic, say, but I can't fall in love with. I guess if you're walking around an art gallery, you can see that there's a really great painting or really great work of art, even if you don't necessarily love it. But yeah, I think it's a really well-made album, a really well-written album, a really well-performed album, but not an album that I love. And I don't know whether that goes back to the first time I listened to it, because I remember listening to Modern Times for the first time and Time Out of Mind and lots of other Bob albums that aren't necessarily classics, and thinking they were great kind of from the off. Whereas with this, I felt like I had to work at it a little bit. And whilst I have got to a place where I do really enjoy it, it's not often an album that I go back to time and time again, or an album that I really kind of... it's not an album that makes my heart sing, let's put it that way. We'll delve into those reasons as to why I like this but not love this album, and also as to why it's such a good record as well in just a second. First though, don't forget, if you can rate or review the podcast wherever you listen, that really does help out, especially on Apple Podcasts. They love a review. I've seen quite a few 5-star reviews going up in the last week or so, so thank you for them. You can also donate to the podcast directly. You can tip the podcast if you want via Buy Me a Coffee. As always, the link to that is in the episode's description. We've had quite a few again over the last week, so thank you for them. Hello to Howard, thanks for donating, mate. Hello to Sweet Pretty Thing, a regular donator, thank you once again. Bart, thank you. Stefan, thank you. Danny, thank you. Alan, thank you. Steve Duck, thank you, mate. Michael A. Thomas, thank you very much. Hi to Jackie, who just says sublime. What a one-word review that is. Thank you. I wouldn't describe it as sublime. More me rattling on almost endlessly. But thank you for that. And hi to Pete as well for your huge donation. Nice one. You can donate to the Buy Me a Coffee little tipping system if you want. As I say, the link is in the episode's description. Right, let's get to it, shall we? Let's have a look at 2012's Tempest.
Walk across the desert till I've been right by. I won't even think about what I left behind.
I often feel like Bob's run from 1997 to 2012 is the run that really made him. I mean, any half-decent singer-songwriter worth their salt can churn out successive classic albums in the 60s. That's easy. Okay, I'm obviously being facetious there, but there is actually a point to be made here. It's one I've made many times before, so forgive me for repeating myself. But when Bob did make that return to form with 1997's Time Out of Mind and its critical reception, Grammy honours and now longevity, which includes the continued success of Make You Feel My Love as a 21st century love ballad in its multiple forms, he really cemented himself in the Hall of Fame. Sure, he's always been there, there's no doubt about that. He's always been at the top of it too. But this time, it was like a cherry on the cake. Too many times we've seen artists as big as Bob fall at the end of their careers. They fall into mediocrity, they become infatuated with uncommercial or unpopular projects. See Sting's dalliance with the lute, for example. No, I'm not sorry. Or artists just point blank give up. But for this 6-album run that came from Time Out of Mind to Tempest, it was a prolonged and sustained return to form from Bob. It wasn't like in the 80s where we had the false dawns of Infidels or Oh Mercy, both greeted with average follow-ups. This was the real deal. It's like they rebooted Dylan. Time Out of Mind was his Casino Royale, a fresh take on a beloved 60s icon that had started to look his age, but now looked fresher than ever. With these albums, Dylan's career would have something that so many others don't have, and that is a continued commercial and critical success decades in. And what I love most about it is that he did it his way. There's no shift in sound to a younger audience. In fact, there's no shift to a sound that is actually that commercial in capital letters at all. He kept it quite interesting for the most part. Time Out of Mind is especially a weird record, as is the accordion heavy Together Through Life, and that doesn't stop the former going platinum and the latter going to number one. By the time we get to 2012 and Tempest, Bob is on a victory lap. In hindsight, it was no surprise we'd have a little break after this. In fact, even at the time, I remember feeling like this whole thing was coming to an end. And that might not be too surprising for reasons that we'll discuss in a second. But with this record, Dylan had already secured a stellar return, and now we were treated to more of the same. Except here, it's just a little bit different compared to before. Time Out of Mind, Love and Theft and Modern Times all felt like they existed in the same universe. You could easily add Together Through Life 2 to that. In fact, Bob sees Together Through Life, Modern Times and Love and Theft more as a trio than the other three. While sonically the album started to change, most notably with that 2009 accordion, they all contemplated similar themes. Tempest feels a little bit different compared to those. Gone are the scorched earth landscapes of previous albums, and here we go back in time, drifting around an old, often strange America and beyond. There's also a little bit more oomph here, for want of a better phrase. It's less desolate than some of the previous albums, something that might be indicated by the record's stormy title. The references on this record point to blues and early rock and roll, which remains the same from before, but there's new cultural ones too. The Titanic and Shakespeare and John Lennon are all introduced in style. And while Bob has had a little affair with some or all of those three, they are here a little bit more in focus than perhaps elsewhere. Of course, Bob doesn't leave his recent past behind. There's still a mixture of the previous three albums on this one too. In fact, that's true in a literal sense on the album's opening track, which continues Bob's collaboration from Together Through Life with American lyricist Robert Hunter. This has led to speculation that this song was left over from the previous album due to the fact it is the only Dylan Hunter collaboration here. And if it is, then you can see why. It's a slightly different sounding song sonically to the others. And while the lyrics echo some of what is happening on the 2009 LP2, it's also slightly different. This is a strange song to get a wrangle on. For me, it means, or at least it could mean, a lot of different things. Dylan opens it with, "Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like it's gonna sweep my world away. I wanna stop at Carbondale and keep on going. That Duquesne train gonna ride me night and day." We're greeted with the idea of a train here, a Duquesne whistle, a fertile metaphor for Bob and the world he's inspired by. This actually comes from the Duquesne line, which ran between New York and Pittsburgh. Amtrak's Keystone was a train service that went from New York Penn Station to Pittsburgh Penn Station. The idea of this train here could easily be an update on Bob's slow train coming, which seemed to warn of an Armageddon, or at least warn of trying to make things right before the end. In the second verse here, Bob sings, "Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like she never blowed before. Blue light blinking, red light glowing, blowing like she's at my chamber door." That final line there seems to nod to the famous rapping on the chamber door in Edgar Allan Poe's Brilliant the Raven, a source that Bob is definitely a fan of and has referenced multiple times. This has been read as a sign of death. In the Raven, Poe's story centres round, quote, "mournful, never-ending remembrance," as a narrator's sorrow for his lost perfect maiden is the driving force behind his conversation with the Raven. So we're back with those previous themes of regret and slipping away found on the other albums in this era. Well, maybe. But again, like I said, here it's a little more brimstone and fire than disillusionment and corruption. The recurring theme of Pennsylvania, including the mention of Carbondale, seems to be a very specific one for Bob. Especially when we find out that the Duquesne whistle was also the name of the largest blast furnace in the world, named Dorothy 6, built actually in Duquesne, Pennsylvania. This adds some fire, literally, to that metaphor. The unstoppable nature of the high-speed heavy train is suitable to the themes that seem to be lingering in this song. It's also in Bob's wheelhouse too, which is important. Trains are intrinsically linked with his music and the music he loves, for all the reasons we see in this song. The imagery and musicality of them is easy and effective to use. This is much more of a Bob thing than, say, him being inspired to write a song about a spaceship. Elsewhere he sings, "You smiling through the fence at me, just like you always smile before. Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like she's gonna blow no more." There is a sense of a ticking clock in this song, good in any writing. It's there in the final line of Blowing Like She Ain't Gonna Blow No More. And elsewhere too in lines like Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, sounding like it's on the final run. This adds a feeling of unstoppable doom and also drama to the song as well. It's cleverly done and injected with a real death hand by Bob. This high-powered train is on its final run with that furnace blaring in the background with fire and brimstone all around it. Also in the verse we hear about someone else, someone smiling through the fence. This person seems to reoccur in the song. Is she perhaps Bob's long-lost maiden, just like from The Raven? Later we hear, can't you hear that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like the sky is gonna blow apart? You're the only thing alive that keeps me going. You're like a time bomb in my heart. Again, another reference to time running out. In the fourth chorus, or at least quasi-chorus, Bob sings, I wake up every morning with that woman in my bed. Everybody telling me she's gone to my head. Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like it's gonna kill me. Dead. Perhaps there is a distinction between the woman in this song and the you that's referred to elsewhere. Is this woman representative of the narrator's life that has taken a turn for the worse, heading to doom with that chugging train in the background? Bob sings, I can hear a sweet voice steadily calling, must be the mother of our Lord. Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like my woman's on board. This is possibly a reference to Steamboat Man by Earl Shirky and Ron Harper from 1928. In that song, the lyrics read, thought I'd heard that steamboat whistle a-blowing, and she blowed like she'd never blow before. I'm afraid my little lover's on that boat, and it will take her to Lord knows where.
I can hear a sweet voice gently calling, must be the mother of our Lord. Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blow like my woman's on board.
So perhaps in these songs, we are once again on that well-trodden theme of the house carpenter, or as is otherwise known, the demon lover, which, as we've heard on previous episodes of this podcast, is all about a stolen lover. At the end of the song, Bob looks back, and as we've seen a lot of in this era, there is a glimmer of hope. Remember in Highlands, when he is there in his mind already, and that's good enough for now? Well, here he's reminiscing about an old oak tree. An image that is a world away from this fiery runaway train. Bob sings, I wonder if that old oak tree's still standing, that old oak tree that we used to climb. Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like she's blowing right on time. Nothing in reality can stop this train. It's still right on time. Life and possible doom of everything, or at least something special, is there and is going to happen. Time and regrets are unstoppable.
Can't you hear that Duquesne whistle blowing? Blowing through another no good town. The lights of my native land are glowing. I wonder if they'll know me next time round. I wonder if that old oak tree's still standing. That old oak tree, the one we used to climb. Listen to that Duquesne whistle blowing, blowing like she's blowing right on time.
There's been some suggestion online that this song could be about a tornado. And indeed, on Sunday, the 22nd of May 2011, a huge multiple vortex tornado struck Joplin and Duquesne, Missouri. It was the third tornado to hit the area since 1971, and it killed 158 people, injuring some 1,150 others. This fits those final oak tree lines nicely, and of course the album's title too, which by its very definition is a very violent storm. Torrential rain and a howling tempest cut a swathe of destruction across the country, but it is slightly at odds with some other lines here. Regardless, when you ignore the specifics, like all of our interpretations, it does fit within the theme of the song. There's something unstoppable here, and it does blend nicely with life and time. Next, we find ourselves in a Midsummer Night's Dream of a Love Song, which starts with a radio-sounding effect across all tracks and ends with Dylan telling us it's soon after midnight and he has a date with a fairy queen. Bob's always been a great love poet, and here we leave the relentless pace of Duquesne Whistle behind for a more muted reflection. His vocal is a highlight here, as is Donny Herron's steel guitar solo. The recording, from a technical point of view, is really great. It's clean and it almost has the perfect mix as well, which adds wonderfully to the whole stillness at the heart of the song. We open the lyrical side of things with a nice couplet. Bob sings, "I'm searching for phrases to sing your praises," which sounds like Dylan could be back on the sonnet train, but also maybe something else. This has been linked with Psalm 144, which reads, "O God, upon a psaltery and an instrument of 10 strings, I will sing praises unto thee." Dylan himself has told us before making Tempest he'd originally conceived doing a religious album. In 2012, he gave a quote to Rolling Stone that is as follows. "I wanted to make something more religious. I just didn't have enough religious songs. Intentionally, though, specifically religious songs is what I wanted to do. That takes a lot more concentration to pull off than the record I ended up with." Of course, as we've seen on this podcast many times, Dylan has been sneaking, no, not even sneaking, just including religious phrases, imagery, and just about everything else in his work ever since he started writing. That so-called Christian phase was obviously more overt, but of course he's been using the Bible as a writing tool and a muse and a North Star pretty much all at once since he began. And that continues on this record too. In fact, this track could easily be along similar lines to tracks on Saved, for example. And while we could easily make compelling arguments that this song is about human psychology or a man looking for redemption, I keep coming back to Dylan singing about God. The searching for phrases line puts me into that space straight away, and I can't seem to shake it off. Elsewhere, our narrator seems to have been wronged. Bob sings, "A girl named Honey took my money," which is possibly a reference to Money Honey, written by Jesse Stone, a song that Bob has covered live. He continues with, "She was passing by, it's soon after midnight, and the moon is in my eye." "Moon Got in My Eyes" is a song recorded by Frank Sinatra, and the refrain of that is, "Out of the darkness you suddenly appeared, you smiled and I was taken by surprise. I guess I should have seen right through you, but the moon got in my eyes." It also reminds me of the Joni Mitchell song, "Last Time I Saw Richard." Both use this phrase to depict a character who is lost or not quite seeing the situation properly. They are blinded by something. Could our narrator be depicting a time before he offered himself to God, a time when he was in the darkness, unable to see clearly? But then he appears to suggest he's not afraid. Bob sings, "I'm in no great hurry. I'm not afraid of your fury. I've faced stronger walls than yours." The fury of God, or God's wrath, is a well-known phrase. So perhaps here the narrator is saying, despite their wrongdoings, they are not afraid as they are loyal to God, unlike some others to come. They will accept their punishment. There's a similar switch in the next verse, as we start with something that almost regurgitates the honey money idea from earlier, or that Killing Floors line. Bob sings, "Charlotte's a harlot, dresses in scarlet." But again, there's hope in the second half of the verse. "Mary dresses in green. It's soon after midnight, and I've got a date with the Fairy Queen." Mary, another nod to the Bible perhaps, is dressed in the colour of health, nature, and luck. We've gone from that colour of scarlet, which has long been associated with prostitution. A scarlet woman is, after all, a woman who is notorious for having many casual sexual encounters or relationships. It is used in the book of Genesis as well, when twins are conceived through adultery. And in Revelation chapter 17, quote, "So the angel took me in the spirit into the wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that had 7 heads and 10 horns, and blasphemies against God were written all over it." Is our narrator gaining redemption through this song, going from one world of scarlet to another world of green? "I've Got a Date with the Fairy Queen" is perhaps a reference to William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. In the play, the character Bottom has an encounter with a fairy queen shortly after midnight. Or it could be referencing The Fairy Queen, a poem written in the late 1500s by Edmund Spenser. The Fairy Queen character, or Gloriana, was representing glory, almost literally, on a moral level. So perhaps our narrator is trying to escape their sins, or even a world of sins, and find love in the Lord. There's an underlying sense of struggle here, but there's plenty of hope too, once again. Unlike some previous compositions from this era, the narrator seems to be winning the battle against their demons.
"More than ever, when I met you, I didn't think you would do. It's soon after midnight, and I don't want nobody but you."
There's another place we visit on the album that seems to be steeped in sin. It's track 6, and it sees that colour returning. Its name is Scarlet Town. Dylan opens the song by giving us the idea of what this place is like. He sings, "In Scarlet Town where I was born, there's ivy leaf and silver thorn. The streets have names that you couldn't pronounce. Gold is down to a quarter of an ounce. The music starts and the people sway. Everyone says, are you going my way? Uncle Tom's still working for Uncle Bill. Scarlet Town is under the hill." It doesn't seem to be a particularly good place, this. There's an allusion to a crown of thorns with ivy leaf and silver thorn, which was a moment in the Bible where Jesus was mocked before the crucifixion. This puts us in a pretty bleak place right to begin with. Not unlike the song that we just looked at, when you think about it. At one point, Dylan sings, "Beggars crouching at the gate, help comes, but it comes too late. By marble slabs and fields of stone, make your humble wishes known." But actually, as things progress, we see it's a little more of a real-world situation than hell or an apocalyptic land. In fact, Scarlet Town might not be a bad place after all. It's just a, well, normal place. There's good and bad there. Dylan tells us the 7 wonders of the world are here, the evil and the good living side by side. So we see we're in a place that might be a little grim at times, in fact, a lot of the time, but that's just the world we live in. It can feel like hell sometimes. Our narrator sets the scene, bringing some nice detail as he does. There's a ton of references which might not come as too much of a surprise. These days, I think it's fun to try and connect every single line to a reference, but we could just fall into the black hole of connections. And while it can help aid an impression of the song, usually it's just a fact-finding mission. There is one reference that stood out to me, though, and it's a strange one. It's the phrase, "Are you going to go my way?" which I wouldn't normally connect to the Lenny Kravitz 1993 song, "Are you going to go my way?" but I might just do that. Having just heard Lenny Kravitz tell a story on the radio about his friendship with Bob might mean this is sticking out to me when it probably shouldn't. Kravitz has got a few, by the way, including meeting Bob in Paris and Bob demanding they go for a walk in the rain, sitting on a park bench as they do, which is one of my favourite weird Bob stories. Anyway, the reason I do mention it is because after the Dylan story, he talks about the meaning of his song, an interpretation of which is all about Jesus Christ, who Lenny Kravitz calls the ultimate rock star. The song is about how God gives choice to man and about where to turn. The opening lyrics spell it out. "I was born long ago. I am the chosen. I'm the one. I have to come to save the day, and I won't leave until I'm done." Sure, this is a stretch, but this song does seem to share themes that would emerge in Scarlet Town, and how later on there seems to be some kind of saviour or judgement. If that feels a little too tenuous, then this maybe won't. The Bob song is connected to another tune called Barbara Allen. Barbara Allen is a traditional folk song that is popular throughout the English-speaking world and beyond. It tells the cheery story of a young man who lies on his deathbed and calls out for Barbara. She takes her time getting to him, though, only to treat him coldly due to a social foul he committed against her at a tavern. On her journey home, she hears a, quote, death bell, and she knows it tolls for her lover, William. Suddenly, she regrets her hardness and knows she will soon die of grief for him. Bob has covered the song live before, and here he uses some of its lyrics. The traditional song starts with what forms the basis for Bob's song. The lyrics are, "In Scarlet Town where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling. Made every youth cry, well a day. Her name was Barbara Allen." In the second verse, Bob sings Scarlet Town in the month of May. Whilst in the second verse of Barbara Allen, we hear, "All in the merry month of May, when green buds they were swelling." The man in Barbara Allen then dies, and we assume the same fate is dished out to our sweet William too, as Bob sings, "There's palm leaf shadows and scattered flowers, beggars crouching at the gate. Help comes, but it comes too late." After this, everything seems to be a bit of a mess. In Scarlet Town, crying won't do you no good. There's talk of fighting long-time foes and drugs and booze and torn hems as well. By the end, there seems to be some sort of attempt at redemption. Perhaps like in the Barbara Allen song, there is an acknowledgement of wrongdoing and an acknowledgement of acceptance or responsibility. As Bob sings, "I'm staying up late, I'm making amends. While we smile, all heaven descends. If love is a sin, then beauty is a crime. All things are beautiful in their time." Perhaps our narrator knows they've done wrong. They've had something before, all things are beautiful in their time, but now heaven is descending and the game is up. In the opening lines of that final verse, Bob sings, "Set 'em Joe, play walking the floor. which feels like a prelude to that JFK radio request list in Murder Most Foul, which might be a reference to the country singer Ernest Tubb's track Walking the Floor Over You. The story behind that track was about a man who is restless and finds himself pacing around the house, which is not unlike our character here.
In Scarlet Town, where I was born, there's Ivy Leaf and Silver Thorn. The streets have names that you can't pronounce. Gold is down to a quarter of an ounce. The music starts and the people sway. Everybody says.
Next, we are taken out of this pleasant slumber with the riff-heavy Narrow Way. It's another blues song, but surprisingly, it's 15-bar blues. We're into Robert Johnson territory here. But of course, a biblical reference is never far away. That opening line about a desert could be a reference to Moses' famous 40-year trek. But more likely, it's the first line of the chorus, "It's a long road, it's a long and narrow way," that is a reference to a passage from the Gospel of Matthew. Bob has included something similar in the 1979 song When He Returns, "Truth is an arrow and the gate is narrow that it passes through." This is an interesting connection given Dylan's comments about wanting to make an overtly religious album this time round, and the albeit slightly tenuous link between the opening track and Slow Train's motif. The actual quote from the Gospel of Matthew is, "Straight is the gate and narrow is the way, which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it." For me, that represents taking the right path, or the straight path, rather than the easy one or the broad one. So could we once again here, like in previous songs, be back on the path of struggling to lead the right life, or the moral life? Once again, our narrator is striving to sing the praises of God, and he's still looking for that date with a fairy queen to get away from it all. Once again, these conclusions remind me this album is different in tone to some others. Gone is that desolation and emptiness. Here they're replaced with conflict, sure, but conflict that is hopeful and striving for something rather than concentrating on all that is lost. Gone is our narrator stumbling around a destroyed earth. Here, for the most part, they seem to be trying to work it all out rather than trying to work out where it went wrong. There is a definite shift here on this album, and that's also present on the introspective Long and Wasted Years. On this track, we see another departure from before as we have a half-spoken delivery from Bob over a rotating riff. There's no chorus or no bridge, well, not really. It's kind of a ramble, but in a good way. It's the sort of song that only Dylan can pull off. A song like Up to Me and the like. It just sort of goes on and on and on without ever really changing. Yet, it still manages to be enthralling. How does he do that? There's moments that almost sound like Bob is a Bob Dylan impersonator here too. It's almost like a parody Dylan. See the line, "I just came to you because you're a friend of mine." Elsewhere it seems we are post-breakup with our narrator and his love. There's a mention of an aisle towards the end of the song, and there's other references to a relationship that either is over or certainly on autopilot. There's questions and things that can only be said in someone's sleep, apparently. Problems that are there that are just under the surface and not quite out in the open yet. There's another train metaphor too. It's a nice couplet as Bob sings, "Two trains running side by side, 40 miles wide, down the eastern line. There's two trains, each on a track going in the same way, side by side, but they're not together. They're just in tandem, not connected." However, it doesn't seem like our narrator is defeated. Later Bob sings, "I wear dark glasses to cover my eyes. There are secrets in them that I can't disguise. Come back, baby, if I hurt your feelings, I apologise." It's not a huge declaration of love. This isn't a I want you back song, nor is it a type of fuck you song. It's a song about wasted time, yes, but they realise it. And if you realised wasted time, then even the smallest amount can still be saved. So while the final lines are devastating, they don't appear to quite be the end. "We cried on a cold and frosted morn. We cried because our souls were torn. So much for tears, so much for long and wasted years."
We cried on a cold and frosty morn. We cried because our souls were torn. So much for tears, so much for these long and wasted years.
As we move into the next part of the album, things take a turn. Musically, there's some surprises on the way, but on track 5, Pay and Blood, we lose the passivity of some of the other previous tracks and dive headfirst into Revenge and Recompense. Dylan apparently wrote the lyrics to this song at some point in the first half of 2011. Bob's friend and fellow songwriter Elvis Costello recalled in an interview with The Guardian that Dylan had read him the lyrics at the West Coast Blues and Roots Festival in Australia. Both men were performing there in April 2011. He says, Dylan pulled out a narrow roll of paper from his jacket, not unlike a London bus ticket. He unfurled it and proceeded to recite a new song that was scrawled upon it. It was called Pay and Blood. Each time the chorus line came round, I pay in blood but not my own, it was delivered with a different flourish, a swashbuckler's panache, a black comical riposte, held with a steely gaze, tossed away with a wicked laugh or a ghostly smile. Okay, Elvis, we get the point. The song is aggressive and dark. At one point, Dylan calls someone a bastard and asks why he should show them respect. Elsewhere, he talks about breaking someone's lousy head. The opening lines set up this tone perfectly. He sings, well, I'm grinding my life out steady and sure, nothing more wretched than what I must endure. I'm drenched in the light that shines from the sun. I could stone you to death for the wrongs that you've done. The stoning to death sets the biblical imagery going almost straight away, and as always, that continues as we move through the verse and chorus. Our narrator seems to be carrying out some of the Lord's work here, but he's an aggressor. Dylan paints him out as someone who is marginalised or is restricted, someone from a lower class perhaps, or someone who is out of step with the world, perhaps morally, as we come to see. He sings, low cards are what I've got, but I play this hand whether I like it or not. I'm sworn to uphold the laws of God. You could put me out in front of a firing squad. Later in the chorus, Bob sings what for me is a key line. My head's so hard, must be made of stone. I pay in blood, but not my own. In an interview with Rolling Stone, Dylan gives us an insight into that particular part of the song. He says, that line is from the book of Ezekiel, chapter 3, verse 9. Ezekiel is told by the Lord to go to the house of Israel, a very stubborn and hard-headed people. The Lord promises to make Ezekiel as hard-headed as they are. If you continue to read the passage, it goes on to say that he is made a watchman by God. The watchman's responsibility is to warn people about impending disaster. If they don't listen, then the blood is on their heads. It's on their hands. However, if the watchman fails to warn people, the blood is on his head. So perhaps our narrator is an Ezekiel-type figure then. They pay in blood, but not their own, suggests that Dylan says, as he says there, that it's not their blood that is the currency of his work. He's warning the people, and if they're not listening, well, that's their problem. As always, in these types of Dylan songs, it seems the narrator is not being listened to, which is where we get our aggressive tone from. In fact, it seems to have sent the narrator half mad. He seems troubled and unhinged at times. Towards the end of the song, Dylan is blasting almost everyone as he sings, how I made it back home nobody knows, or how I survived so many blows. I've been through hell, what good did it do?
Come here, I'll break your lousy head. Nation must be saved and freed. You've been accused of murder. How do you plead? This is how I spend my days. I came to bury without two ways. I drink my fill and sleep alone. I pay in blood, but not my own.
The sort of impending doom here is common ground for Bob, and I think he might be at it again on the album's title track. Tempest is a 14-minute epic. It depicts the sinking of the Titanic. Now, I know this is an easy thought to leap to, and it's one that James Cameron, the director of the 1997 film Titanic, himself has made, but I don't think it's out of question to say that the sinking of the Titanic and its inevitability, from our vantage point at least, is a good metaphor for, you guessed it, the end of the world. Yes, we're back here again. In 2012, whilst appearing on a climate change show on National Geographic, James Cameron said of his Oscar-winning picture, part of the Titanic parable is of arrogance, of hubris, of the sense that we're too big to fail. Well, where have we heard that before? While I don't think Dylan is writing a song about climate change and its inevitable effect on us, I think he clearly relates to the themes that this great ship represents. Like Cameron said, there is a parable of arrogance, of hubris here, not a million miles away from what our narrator was getting so worked up about in Paying Blood or in Duquesne Whistle. While there's some fairly straightforward depictions of the disaster and a nod to Leonardo DiCaprio, a star of the 1997 film, in fact, Bob names a man in his song Leo rather than Jack, the actual character's name, which some have found interesting, but I find, I don't know, a little jarring. It's not that I don't think it works, I just don't think it's very good. Bob thinks differently, of course. When asked about it in 2012, he told Rolling Stone, "Yeah, Leo, I don't think that song would have been the same without him, or the movie." People are going to say, well, it's not very truthful, but a songwriter doesn't care about what's truthful. He cares about what should have happened, what could have happened. That's its own kind of truth. Back to the point, though. This metaphor of the Titanic being our world or our attitude or take your pick incorporates death. It doesn't seem to be a make your peace type song, nor does it seem to be a stop your sinning type tirade. More a riff on what does it all mean? It's on life and death and how you live your life for good or bad or for neither. And for me, what's most interesting is that our narrator seems to come to the conclusion that it's all God's and we really can't understand. Bob sings, "They waited at the landing and they tried to understand, but there's no understanding on the judgment of God's hand." Before, we have a nod to an end-of-days type Titanic metaphor as he sings, "In dark illumination he remembered bygone years. He read the book of Revelation and it filled his cup with tears. When the reaper's task has ended, 1600 are gone to rest. The good, the bad, the rich, the poor, the loveliest and the best." The Titanic is a microcosm of our world. Its classes, its people, its journey, its voyage was like a timeline of life itself, a whole generation or even a whole world. I guess that no matter who you are, rich, poor, good or bad, judgment in the end comes to us all, eventually. We're all on that ship and we're all going to eventual death. Sorry to dampen the mood a little bit. And do you know what? We can't possibly understand it all.
There were many, many others, nameless here forevermore. They'd never sailed the ocean or left their homes before. The once when he lay dreaming, the damage had begun. He dreamed the Titanic was sinking and he tried to tell someone.
Dylan has acknowledged the Carter family's recording of the Titanic, aka After the Sinking of the Titanic, a song believed to have been written by Seth Mutton Mize in the early 1920s. In that 2012 interview with Rolling Stone, he said, "I was just fooling around with that one night. I liked the melody. I liked it a lot. Maybe I thought I was going to incorporate the melody somewhere, but I didn't know where to go with it." Harvard University classics professor Richard F. Thomas discovered that Dylan began writing the first draft of this song on hotel stationery during the European leg of his never-ending tour in the summer of 2010. And the song progressed from alphabetical word lists written in Istanbul in late May to the almost finished song in Spain just 1 month later. By the time we reach the end of the song, Bob sounds pretty level-headed. That violin sound on the tune gives us the slightest jovial hints, which is akin to the below-the-deck scenes in the Cameron film. We finish with a sad but understanding tone. It's something that is carried on into the album's final track, Roll On John. It's another epic. It closes a side of epics. It's no wonder that, along with the album sharing the name of the final Shakespearean play, that people thought this was Bob's last ever release. The whole side has an encore feeling about it. A last night at the opera kind of vibe. Bob is often grumpy about nostalgia. I think he does his best to avoid it for obvious reasons. He's been trying to get away from his past for over 60 years. He doesn't want to dwell on the previous. I think this might have been the case, seemingly, when he spoke to former podcast guest Jeff Slate in a recent interview. He named some surprising musical acts on his Spotify playlist, most of which quelled the old man shouting at a cloud type feeling. But I suspect sometimes he enjoys a little bit of nostalgia, as a guilty pleasure, perhaps. Here he writes an ode to old-time friend and sometimes sparring partner, John Lennon. Lennon and Bob have a complicated relationship. A while ago, I discussed their friendship and everything else on the Lennon Glass Onion podcast. We could spend a whole series looking at their ups and downs, the lowest being Lennon's rehash of Bob's Gonna Serve Somebody, the aptly titled Serve Yourself. But I think on the whole, whilst often strained, their relationship was one of mutual respect. It's no doubt that Bob became better friends with another Beatle and fellow travelling Wilbury, George Harrison. In fact, Harrison seems almost infatuated with Bobby. Not that we can talk, of course. But with Lennon, it always felt like they were too similar to be the best of friends. Maybe not as people, but they were both rock stars. They were both the main characters. And yes, while Paul McCartney is a big creative force, as big as Lennon, in my opinion, it always felt like Lennon was the alpha male of sorts. Maybe not always in the studio, but in character, in interviews. That is the same with Dylan. The term alpha male there feels a little bit outdated, I know. I don't mean that they're, you know, talking about cryptocurrency and vaping. I mean, they were both born to be front people. I think Dylan felt a kinship with Lennon, even if at times it was from afar. Both of them have had similar experiences. Again, I think more so than McCartney and Bob. Lennon was scrutinised, exactly like Dylan, for politics and beliefs and everything else. Their interviews were both looked closely into by almost everyone for any inaccuracies or any opinions that they could talk about. They both had fame in a similar way. They experienced it in a similar way. Lennon is possibly the only other person in that generation that was considered a voice of it, like Bob. So all these years later, with all that water under the bridge, Dylan is talking to possibly the only other person in the universe that has been through almost exactly what he went through. Lennon's demise also might sit coldly with Bob, because without sounding morose, it could have easily been Bob ending up in tragedy just like Lennon. Roll on John starts like an official account, as we hear of Lennon's death, but that then blossoms into a full-blown tribute. There's Beatle references aplenty, of course, from the band's original name in their time in Germany to the Sgt. Pepper's LP to the White Album. Again, we could go through them all and spend all day doing that. While at the start of the song, Lennon is shot. I've always felt we kind of spend the rest of it slowly watching him take a walk into the light. In the end, Bob sings, "Tiger, tiger, burning bright, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. In the forests of the night, cover 'em over and let them sleep. Shine your light. Moving on, you burn so bright. Roll on, John." One of my favourite lyrics is, "Roll through the rain and snow, take the right-hand road and go to where the buffalo roam." It always stuck out at me, and on further inspection might be a reference to the 1980 film Where the Buffaloes Roam, which was a semi-biographical comedy film loosely based on the author Hunter S. Thompson's rise to fame in the 1970s. Who's on the soundtrack of this film released in the year of Lennon's death? You guessed it, Bob, with his songs Highway 61 Revisited and All Along the Watchtower. And of course, so is John too, with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Together they are there, and together they are here on this song.
Roll on, John, roll through the rain and snow. Take the right-hand road and go where the buffaloes go. They'll trap you in an ambush for you know. Too late now to sail back. Burn so bright, roll on down.
Death is also present on the seemingly never-ending Tin Angel. The bass line on this song from the legendary Tony Garnier goes round and round and round and round. He deserves an award for perseverance if he played it live during the recording, which I suspect was the case. I can't imagine Dylan wanting this bass line looped. The melody dances around and isn't afraid to show its country blues roots. This is also present in a lot of the words too. The opener of "It was late last night when the boss came home" is also the first line of the traditional folk song Gypsy Davy. This was performed by Woody Guthrie, amongst others. The plot of that song is a woman leaves her husband for another man and her husband rides after her, and that's pretty much what happens here too. Later we hear the boss's wife has run off with someone called Henry Lee. Henry Lee is found in the classic American folk song of the same name by Dick Justice. That song is also about a crime of passion too. In Justice's Henry Lee, a woman who murdered the man she had forsaken attempts to lure down a tattletale bird from its cage. Again, that relates to this song. The boss goes off to find his wife, and spoiler alert, they all die in a Shakespearean tragedy-type climax. He kills him, she kills him, and then she kills herself. You know the deal. There's a lot of ferocious reading into this song, but for me, it's kind of a straightforward story, really. Sure, it's not amazing, and its effect can be dulled on repeated listens, but it's still pretty good. Just before this is track 7, Early Roman Kings. This is a blues track that has a pretty recognisable riff, which is mixed quite high in the song. That was Dylan's choice. He is the producer here under the pseudonym Jack Frost. He also throws in an accordion and a ghostly sounding organ all backed up with that guitar playing that riff.
All the early Roman kings in their sharkskin suits, bow ties and buttons.
The song's words at first glance might suggest that Dylan is diving into ancient Rome, a place where he often likes to go. But there's also a thought to say he might be referencing a New York street gang. Tony Atwood, an online Dylan commentator, or to give him the slightly pompous name which we tend to give these people, a Dylan scholar, he suggests this world of New York in the 70s might blend with this world of ancient Rome. The street gang in question were called the Roman Kings, and whilst, yes, they were a street gang made up of teenagers, there's two sides to the story. In 1972, in a piece that shocked many, Peter Hamill in the New York Post wrote, "The best single thing that happened on the streets of New York in the last 10 years is the re-emergence of teenage street gangs. Those young people are standing up for life, and if their courage lasts, they'll help this city survive." Which doesn't sound a million miles away from our narrator in Pay and Blood, an aggressive force who is actually doing good when you scratch the surface. Early on in this song, though, Dylan describes the kings as all the early Roman kings in their shark-skin suits, bow ties and buttons, high-top boots. Later we hear all the early Roman kings in the early, early morn, coming down the mountain, disturbing the corn, speeding through the forest, racing down the track. You try to get away, they drag you back. Which adds weight to this theory. But while we can delve into this idea, and many others for that matter, it's a song that almost defies analysis because it's so all over the map and quite ethereal at times. Either way, we hear about a group exercising their control with menace, it seems. There's some killer lines here. For example, "If you see me coming and you're standing there, wave your handkerchief in the air." Or the now infamous, "I can strip you of life, strip you of breath, ship you down to the house of death. One day you will ask for me, there'll be no one else that you'll want to see." Finally, we hear something we have heard quite a lot on this album, a reckoning. There seems to be a lot of conclusions here on this song and on this album too, which again gives weight to the idea that when it was released, this was going to be Dylan's last album. The death of the Titanic passengers, for example, a complete story including death in Tin Angel, the redemption and acceptance in Scarlet Town, that epic quality of the second side of this record, and the John Lennon tribute. And now here, a feeling of finality. But again, unlike other albums, it's not woeful. It's actually quite hard-fisted. Bob sings, "I've had my fun, I've had my flings, gonna shake them all down like the early Roman kings." It sounds like he's ringing in a new dawn of reckoning. Tempest treads a familiar path for Bob, but it walks in a different way. He wanted to make an album of more religious songs, and to an extent he did. The themes of redemption and judgment here are high on the agenda. There's also, like we've seen, a feeling of finality, but also fate, of actions and consequences. Death is littered throughout this album because there's no better agent of consequence or fate than it. The LP is a well-loved album, and you can see why. It's complex and multifaceted and never quite what you think it is. Like all good works of art, it's hard to pin down, and that is its genius. It's almost indescribable in a way. Its themes are a slight departure from other Dylan albums in that its tone is dark, not unusual, but it's also twisted and angry. It's got blood running through its veins. There's lyrics of killing and violence here that are as fierce as anything Dylan has done before. So it's strange that I'm struggling once again with that feeling that I can't quite fall in love with it. I know this is an album that is often called one of Bob's best, but for me, I only like it. I can't fall in love with it. I can tell it's one of his best albums in terms of the music and words, but ironically, for an album that is so up and at 'em, I struggle to find a real excitement in it. For me, it's like sitting in a Bentley or a Ferrari. I don't drive. I've never driven. And I can tell that this car is enjoyable. There's great engineering, great design, etc. But I'm just not emotionally invested. Could it be a lack of a sweeping ballad on this album, a guilty pleasure of mine? Or could it be just a little too grisly for me? This, after all, is like Dylan's horror movie at times. It's his stormy sea nightmare, and I often find myself wanting to escape to the shore, even though the view is impressive. But personal opinions aside, this is Dylan on top of his game once again. After a great run of albums, he finished an era with one of his best. And whilst for a long time many thought this was his last studio album, it would have been a great way to say goodbye. But thankfully, Dylan wasn't done with us. Quite yet.
When I met you, I didn't think you would do. It's soon after midnight, and I don't want nobody but you.
That is it for this episode. I am recording this outro in a different place with a different microphone much later on than I did the episode. So forgive me if there's a slightly jarring change in sound. Most people won't notice it, but for you geeks like me, you will. Fun fact, I had my tonsils out recently, and after recording the last episode, I tried to record an outro, but just couldn't speak anymore. So I just gave up. So I'm doing it now. Let me know your thoughts on Tempest, please, as an album. Do you love it? Is it your favourite album? Like I say, I think many people consider it one of their favourite Dylan albums. I don't think it would make my top five. Probably make my top 10. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see when I inevitably come to do that at some point in my life. Let me know your thoughts on this album, please. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bob Dylan Podcast. Next time, we're having a look at another well-regarded album. We're going to have a look at The Basement Tapes, which is an album that has a fascinating context to it, a story we all know, but it's fun to delve into every now and then, and some great songs as well. We'll get to that next time. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and I'll see you down the road.